You're listening to a 95 BFM podcast.
You're tuned into The Wire, 1 hour of current affairs and analysis starting now.
Tēnā koutou katoa, ko Justin Montauk ingoa. E whakarongo ana koe ki te Wire Marunga irirangi pōho mō tēnei rā, te rā tekau marima o here tūri kōka. Kia ora, you're tuned into the Thursday Wire here on 95BFM with me, Justin Montauk, for today, July 15th. I'm joined with my producer, Connor Hatt-McCarthy, who is quite new on the Thursday Wire. E haere ake nei, coming up on the show today, Parliament's Finance and Expenditure Select Committee is having a review on cryptocurrency. Auckland Council's new plans could see bus routes run through the city. Psychologists are saying they are unable to take in new capacity, and the search for orca calf towers off the Kapiti coast continues. He aha o whakaro, let us know what you think. Tuku pātuhi mai, you can text us on 5395 or waimairane. Call us in studio on 309-3879. Ko wā e ware ware, e ahi ana koutou te whakarongo ki ene kōrero ano hei pakihere rokiroki marunga i te pai tukutuku o irirangi pōho me haere ki 95BFM irakati.com. You can catch all these stories and more by podcasts on, as well as past shows on the 95 BFM website. Now let's talk about cryptocurrency.
Kei te whakarongo koe ki te Wire, marunga irirangi pō.
The Wire.
MPs are launching an inquiry into the use of cryptocurrency like Bitcoin and finding out its risks and benefits. The inquiry by the Finance and Expenditure Select Committee will try to identify how cryptocurrency is created and traded, establish its risks and environmental impacts, and find out how to regulate them. Labour MP Dr. Duncan Webb is the Select Committee's chair, and he joins me on the line now. Kia ora.
Kia ora, how are you?
I'm doing very well, and thanks for joining us on the programme. But first, how much do you know about cryptocurrency before the Select Committee launches this inquiry?
Well, you know, that's one of the reasons we're launching an inquiry, is because around the table, I think we probably know about the same as your average person in the street. We know that there's cryptocurrency. We know of Bitcoin. We know that there's many other cryptocurrencies. We've probably heard the term blockchain. We understand that it's a distributed kind of framework where it's using computers around the world to verify it. We also know that it's a highly volatile market. But of course, we've probably all heard that Bitcoin and other currencies are used for some nefarious purposes. But other than that, I think there's a lot more to learn, especially around the opportunities that cryptocurrencies generally might offer for the economy in New Zealand.
So how will the inquiry be conducted? Do you call in a bunch of experts, or do you rely on public submissions?
Well, that's essentially our first job. As a select committee, we kind of, in this kind of situation, we're able to make our own rules. I'm hopeful that there'll be space for the general public to have their say, and to, you know, because there's a lot of people out there with a lot of knowledge and a lot of opinion as well, and it'll be our job kind of to sift the wheat from the chaff in that respect. But also, we'll be really careful to make sure we get some really expert advice to make sure that, you know, we're not led down the garden path, because there's a lot out there that there's a lot of fear and there's also a lot of exuberance almost, and I think we've got to find a middle path there.
But the concept of cryptocurrency and the terms like you mentioned at the start, like blockchain, has been around for a couple of years already. Is it too late for Parliament to catch up on this?
Oh, look, well, blockchain, you know, Bitcoin was invented, you know, around 12 years ago, I think. So it's been around for a while then. And there's, you know, it's turned into essentially $100 billion assets. Are we too late? Absolutely not. Because I think, you know, we're only just exploring the genuine opportunities of blockchain and cryptocurrency. I mean, the Australians ran a trial where they used it to pay for some social services. And they were, by using the kind of intelligence around cryptocurrencies, they were able to make sure the right person spent the money on the right things with the right suppliers. You know, and that's the kind of thing you can't do with cash as we know it. But nevertheless, it's something we might want to explore.
So this is more like a fact-finding mission.
Well, absolutely, yeah. And look, as it says, and you kind of ran through some of the terms of reference, as it says, it's looking at the risks, because there is, I mean, one of the risks is to the monetary system if cryptocurrencies were to displace the New Zealand dollar as the kind of currency of choice in New Zealand, there'd be real problems around price, you know, inflation and employment and all kinds of things. So there's a potential risk. We don't know how big it is. We want to find out. But also, as I said, fact-finding mission around what the opportunities are. And, you know, the Reserve Bank has already said that it needs to be aware of digital currencies and it needs to consider whether it should itself be issuing digital currencies. Now, they might not be kind of anonymous crypto in the way we think of Bitcoin, but it's still something we need to look at.
So, but based on that, what you said, is it dangerous to not have any oversight on cryptocurrency in New Zealand?
Well, there's a real possibility that if we don't think about where regulation should be and where it's needed, but also kind of the other thing the law does is it enables, and at the moment there's no enabling legislation either. There's nothing that says that crypto needs, you know, can be properly recognised, that it can be traded on a recognised exchange and things like that. So, yes, regulation in terms of making sure people don't, it doesn't run amok, and also to make sure that if there are benefits that we can capture those as well.
So what will the Select Committee do with the inquiry's findings?
Well, look, what we'll probably do is, it's premature to say what we're going to end up with, but at the very least, we'll table a report in Parliament. And if we think there's areas that the government, because this is a parliamentary committee from all MPs from every party, and if we think that the government should be doing something, we'll make recommendations in that report, and you know, we would hope that the responsible ministers would pick that up and essentially put it on their programme of work for the future.
Right. Thanks for joining us, and that was Dr. Duncan Webb, who is the chair of the Parliament's Finance and Expenditure Select Committee, who have just announced a review and inquiry into cryptocurrency. It's ten past noon here in Tamaki Makaurau, Auckland. We will be heading towards a quick break.
Do anything for you. I believe you are a star.
95BFM and Under the Radar present Dimmer, as you've never heard it before. A seven-piece Dimmer band play the iconic I Believe You Are a Star album in full. An experience not to be missed. Saturday, September 25th at the beautiful Mercury Theatre. Tickets available via iTicket.
I believe you are a star.
Not all bread is created equal. In fact, some bread is pretty shit.
You might as well be spreading your Marmite on a chocolate bar.
Bread and Butter's sourdough is real bread, using ancient techniques and organic and regeneratively grown ingredients. Choose substance over speed. Choose age and beauty. Check out their online delivery options or head in store for brunch, great coffee and more homemade pastries than you can shake a baguette at.
Bread and Butter, the best sourdough in town.
Breadandbutter.nz.
On the prowl for your new friendly local? Look no further than Scarecrow, the cafe with great food and groceries, plentiful vegan fare also, alongside a great buzz. Right beside Albert Park, Scarecrow is located at 33 Victoria Street East. Explore their range of food, which is rated amongst the best in town by Heart of the City. Browse their gifts, local flowers, organic teas and coffees. You can also find them at 811 Mount Eden Road. To learn more, call them on 09377 133 or shop online for Auckland-wide delivery at scarecrow.co.nz.
Holly Fulbrook, Ben Andrews, Diva Mahal and Delaney Davidson are all headed underground to play in Waiheke's spookily gorgeous World War II tunnels at Stony Batter. If you'd like to win a super exclusive double pass to one of these hot sessions, then load up your B card and tune into 95BFM Drive with Johnny and Big Hungry all this week. 95BFM presents Interesting Places, the Subterranean Sessions, part of Elemental Auckland, July 17th and 18th at Fortress Stony Batter, Waiheke Island. Tickets from Eventbrite. The Wire.
Like, naked is the theme. Like, people just love getting naked.
Welcome back to The Wire. Now we have a story on psychologists.
Mental health has been an ongoing problem within New Zealand society. Last September, a UNICEF survey revealed that New Zealand placed 38 out of 41 countries in the OECD surveyed for mental well-being. The 2018 wellness budget revealed a detailed plan to help assist mental well-being, but recently the progress it has made has come into question. This week, it was revealed that psychologists in New Zealand are having to turn away patients as there aren't enough trained psychologists to deal with the demand. Today I spoke to Gaynor Parkin, clinical psychologist and CEO of Umbrella Wellbeing, about psychologists having to turn people in need away. In the interview, I asked if this was a systemic issue, what the government is doing to help, and what are some possible solutions. I started off the interview by asking why psychologists had to turn people away.
The answer is fairly straightforward, which is that we have more demand than we can respond to, so there's not enough clinical psychologists in New Zealand currently.
Are there more people needing help now, or is this systemic to the health sector?
It's probably both. So because we've done a good job probably in the last decade or so of de-stigmatising people seeking help for their well-being and mental health and kind of life issues that come up, we do know that more people are reaching out for mental health and well-being support. However, as you said, we also know that there's a problem with our clinical psychology workforce, and we've known that for some time. We're not training enough psychologists year on year, and the demand for clinical psychologists has gone up over the last decade or two, and so there's that real mismatch between what the workforce can provide and what's needed.
Is this an issue that is locally focused to a certain region, or is this a nationwide
issue?
No,
it's unfortunately nationwide. So we find that there are demands for clinical psychologists all over New Zealand, and the shortage of psychologists is all over New Zealand as well.
In 2018, the government announced a new plan for mental health support. Recently, however, the progress of support for mental health has come under question. Do you think enough has been done? People both looking for support and those providing it?
No, absolutely not. I don't think enough has been done. I think we're being, again, too reactive, and we're not doing enough proactive planning to make sure that the workforce can respond to increased demand. And we've known that this is an issue for a while, and I think initiatives have to be faster and more creative than they currently are. So in the UK, they have an initiative called Improving Access, which is a government initiative looking at how to increase people's access to clinical psychologists and other mental health professionals. And Australia has a similar one called Better Access. We don't have that in New Zealand, and we should have.
So that's a solution looking at just providing a better alleyway for people to access support.
Yeah, and both of those programs are looking at how to train more professionals to be able to provide the service that's needed. And I know in the UK, where I have colleagues, they have dramatically increased the number of training places available for clinical psychologists to try and address this more quickly.
So you've mentioned that we're being way too reactive in the way that we're dealing with mental health, and that this sort of system could work to provide more training. But in your opinion, are there any other solutions that the government could enact to help support the mental health sector?
Yes, so there's lots. So one really key initiative, as I said, is increasing the number of qualified professionals that we have available. Second would be we don't do a very good job of supporting psychologists and mental health professionals in doing the work that they do. Most of us who work in this area set up our own networks and support, but it would be great to see some more funds around that, about how do we better support the wellbeing of our professionals. We need to look at better creative solutions. So, for example, most people who are seeking help end up in one-on-one help, and we know that group support can be helpful for people, so looking at those initiatives would be useful. As you know, we have some evidence that digital help can be useful for people, so we don't necessarily need the person sitting in an office with a psychologist or a mental health professional. They might be able to access the support online or via text or via some really clever initiatives that are looking at engaging young people in a gaming environment where they learn mental health skills at the same time. So there's lots of things that we can do to scaffold and provide other forms of help around expert mental health professionals like psychologists.
That was Gaynor Parkin, clinical psychologist and CEO of Umbrella Wellbeing, on the need for more psychologists. Moving on.
Irirangi Po, Radio Bosom.
The Wire.
Auckland Transport released a new city centre bus plan that aims to streamline the bus services in central Auckland to benefit both commuters and businesses. The bus plan is estimated to take 5 to 10 years to complete and give access to both the city centre and the surrounding regions. Today I spoke to two people on this story. I first spoke to Pete Moth, Service Network Development Manager at Auckland Transport, about the plan, the aims of the service, and the pedestrianisation of Auckland Central. I began the interview by asking how the city centre bus plan was going to change the transport network.
So the city centre bus plan responds to the city centre master plan that was adopted by council at the beginning of 2020, and it proposes a three-step change to the way buses operate in the city centre. The first step is to create dedicated bus corridors along Customs Fanshawe Street and also on Wellesley Street to give better reliability for buses and also to get more people into the city and through the city. The second step is to create dedicated off-street bus facilities. So the buses, instead of terminating in the city centre on street, they head to off-street locations, and that will help free up around 1 kilometre of curbside space. And then thirdly, we propose to change the network so that buses will run through the city centre and not simply to the city centre, so that buses will run through Custom Street, Wellesley Street to those off-street bus locations.
What is the overall aim for the city centre bus plan?
The overall aim for the city centre bus plan is to create better circumstances for bus passengers. It's also to create a better operating environment for buses. And really, it's to help to deliver on the city centre master plan that was adopted last year.
It's my understanding that this plan is going to take 5 to 10 years to implement. Why is this plan going to take almost a decade to implement, and what are the barriers Auckland Transport face?
So one of the main barriers we face is securing the necessary consents and funding. So the reason this is a 5 to 10 year vision for buses and not something we can do overnight is because we need to secure land. We need to do detailed design. We need to do consultation. We need to do a lot of work with stakeholders, landowners, residents, businesses, to make sure that what we're proposing will work for the residents, businesses, and users of the city centre. And at the moment, there's so much going on in the city centre that it would not be a good time to add additional construction into the fold. So this is a project that would take place after the City Rail Link is delivered.
Does this project also account for the future of Central Auckland as it moves into more sort of a pedestrianised area?
Absolutely, yes. Yeah, so by implementing this plan, we're actually able to free up more than 1 kilometre of curbside space in the city centre. And that space can be used for people, it can be used for goods and servicing, and it doesn't have to be used by buses. Buses are currently taking up a lot of space on street, and that's compromising the ability to make the city centre more friendly for people.
Are there any other regions apart from Auckland Central and Tamaki Makaurau that are needing big changes like this to their transport networks?
I would say our priority is in the city centre at the moment. That's where the biggest challenge is. That's not to say there's not challenges elsewhere in the region, and we recognise that we will need to make improvements to other places across the region, but right now the priority is the city centre.
That was Pete Moth, Service Network Development Manager at Auckland Transport. After speaking to Auckland Transport, I spoke to Matt Lowry, editor of the independent Greater Auckland online platform, about the city centre bus plan. I started the interview off by asking for his perspective on the city centre bus plan.
I think, by and large, it's positive. It's particularly the simplifying routes and making them and sending buses through to the other side of the city. So, for example, if you're coming from the North Shore, it'll be easier to access the inside of the city centre. So changes like that will be really positive for users and make it much easier to catch the bus and more reliable to catch the bus too, because there'll also be more bus priority provided as well.
Will this plan allow greater access to the wider transport network in Tamaki Makaurau for commuters?
Yeah, it will. So by passing routes through the city and by having simplified routes, it will make it easier to get to other parts of the city centre, but also to transfer between services. Currently, services are spread out all over, particularly the downtown area, but all over the city, and so it can be difficult to transfer, to work out where to go, and so this will help make that easier. To transfer services between services to get across Auckland.
Auckland Transport says that this plan is going to take 5 to 10 years to implement. Does this account accordingly for future uses as Auckland Central becomes more pedestrianised?
Yeah, so that part of what the changes are about are about enabling the other parts of, or other changes that the city centre or that Auckland wants in the city centre, so making it more pedestrian friendly, so that it removes routes from a few places and focuses them on a couple of key routes. So focuses them on the east-west on Custom Street and on Wellesley Street. And then you've got the existing Albert Street and Simon Street for north-south travel as well. So it does make things simpler and will help make Auckland more pedestrian-friendly, because it will concentrate those buses on a couple of key routes and leave space open for those other places that they can be used for other things.
Throughout Tamaki Makaurau, public transport and pedestrian access is not universally accessible. Is this new bus plan for Auckland Central a good use of resources for Auckland Transport to focus on?
Well, there are a lot of parts of the plan that are really good, and they can be implemented relatively cheaply and affordably. The big challenge, I think, with this plan is that one of the things they're calling for are sort of big off-street facilities, and so that's mainly about layover space for drivers and for buses between runs, because most people will still catch the bus from the side of the street like they do now. And the problem is that those big off-street bus facilities are going to be hugely expensive, hundreds of millions of dollars worth of spending to implement them. And so that's money that could be used for putting more buses out, or putting more bus lanes, or better bus stops in other parts of the region. So I think that's probably the biggest concern with the proposal, is that it is expensive for some of it, and for probably the parts that are the least needed of what is proposed.
Finally, apart from the expenses there, do you see any other challenges that Auckland Transport may face with implementing this plan?
The challenges that they're going to face are going to be primarily around, first of all, they've got to actually get consent and the funding to build what they want to do. But it's in general the discussion that occurs and the feedback that occurs within Auckland around how we develop this stuff. So, if we go through our typical processes, we're going to have consultation again and again over these things, and it'll be contentious every single time, because it's going to require upsetting a few car drivers when we need to get on and make these changes. And so we need to get better at how we deliver projects and infrastructure like this, so that we can just get on with it rather than trying to accommodate every talkback radio reckon that comes up. And that's really one of the big challenges with transport in Auckland in general, is getting things done, because everyone's too worried about upsetting anyone, really.
That was Pete Moss, Service Network Development Manager at Auckland Transport, and Matt Lowry, Editor of Greater Auckland, on the new city centre bus plan.
Thanks, Connor. Just before we move on, do you take the bus often?
Yeah, I bus every day into uni, and to get here, find it really useful.
Well, I haven't lived in Auckland City for long enough to probably make a conclusion, but what do you think of buses, of the bus service here in general?
I think it's pretty good. Definitely getting into the city is pretty easy, but not really getting around the city centre. So I think these changes are looking pretty good for that sort of east-west access.
Yeah, especially if I want to go from West Auckland to the east, apparently there's no... And a lot of times there aren't a lot of direct routes to go from, let's say, Avondale all the way to Onehunga, but rather you have to go or take the train all the way back into the city centre or change at Newmarket just to go to Onehunga. And frankly, that's not what a city's public transport should be.
Yeah, I definitely think there needs to be more access from like around the whole region. Like, it's important that we get the city centre done right, but I think we do need more access from region to region, because those aren't maybe not the most important trips that people are taking, but they're definitely common enough that we need better access. That's not just like trains or whatever, we need buses as well, I think.
Yeah, especially when I know that the most of the buses here are just congregating on the main routes to go into the city centre, but not alongside the ring routes. I mean, even though we have the outer link, inner link, and the city link, those are not, frankly, they are inadequate enough to connect the fringe Auckland suburbs to others. And they, frankly, their only purpose is to serve the inner suburbs and to connect to the CBD and instead of other places.
Yeah, I definitely agree. I think more access, more buses, more good.
And don't forget, more trains. Hopefully, we'll see more trains coming up soon in the next couple of years, hopefully.
Yeah, I'd love to see a train to the shore. Like, that would be, like, under the bridge, let's go, train to the North Shore.
Well, hopefully we'll see that. Let us know what you think about buses or even cryptocurrency or even psychologists. The text number is 5395, but if you want to talk to us, it's 309-3879. It's just coming up to 34 past noon here in Tamaki Makaurau, Auckland. We will be back after another break, but right now, here's some Troy Kingy.
Time is done, yours is wearing thin, waiting for a spark to kick in. I don't know why everybody doesn't find what feels good and hold it to their belly. Smell the air before the oxygen disappears. I don't know why everybody doesn't hate when there's love. Too many brunches missing their dose. Yeah. We'll be right back.
Tony Barnett is coming to the Auckland Town Hall as part of Elemental Nights, June 25th. With her entire tour nearly sold out, don't miss the chance to see Courtney Barnett at her largest New Zealand show. Courtney Barnett, Sunday, July 25th at the Auckland Town Hall. Get your tickets now from Ticketmaster. Let's hear it for everyone's favourite garden city. Hamilton, city of the future, the rest of you will never catch up. Not to mention the dairy-free options.
Yes. Yeah. Well,
absolutely.
Shaky Isles Coffee, brewed different for entree enjoyers and hometown heroes. Go to shakyisles.co.nz.
Swap the hard stuff for mental clarity and performance this dry July with Arepa, New Zealand's number one brain drink. Caffeine-free, plant-based and clinically tested, Arepa is proven by neuroscience to keep you calm and thinking clear when you need it most. Arepa, 100% natural effects you can feel. The world's smartest brain food. Found in all good supermarkets or buy online at drinkarepa.com.
Banish Music, in association with 95BFM, presents Lawrence Arabia live at the Point Chev RSA, September 18th. Celebrating the 12 and a half year anniversary of Chant Darling, Lawrence Arabia and band are heading to Auckland, playing the album in full and delving into Lawrence's deepest cuts and biggest bangers. Lawrence Arabia does Chant Darling, Saturday, September 18th at Point Chev RSA. Get your tickets now from Banish Music.
Seabiscuit's a wanker. Black Beauty's been checked out since 96. Farlap's dead and Australian.
But there are still some equine chums who know how to show you a bloody good time. Pony Ping Pong on 95BFM. Every Friday night, Matt and Aaron are here to blast open your weekend with a mix of mashdowns, candid convos, cheap shots, and mystery celebrity nakedness. Pony Ping Pong. Friday, 9 to 11pm, only on 95BFM.
Can anyone explain why the modern-day whales are so big?
The Wire.
Welcome back to The Wire, and for our final story of today, the hunt for the family of a stranded baby orca alongside the Kapiti coast is continuing into the fourth day. The four-month-old orca named Toa was discovered stranded on Plimerton Beach, which is north of Porirua, on Sunday. Rescuers have been keeping watch on Toa, and he has been in a positive condition, while volunteers have been flying up and down the Kapiti coast to locate Toa's pod. There had been several reported sightings from the past 48 hours, but nothing has been confirmed, and there have been no reported orca pod sightings this morning. The CNS search has been halted pending more reported sightings for today. However, the weather in the region is expected to worsen over the next 24 hours, and the Department of Conservation is now planning to strengthen Toa's temporary pen, which is located in Plimerton Boat Club. Professor Karen Stocken is from Massey University School of Natural and Computational Science, and I spoke to her about this, and I began by asking if it is common to see an orca cove being left behind without their pod.
To be fair, I kind of feel that this calf really didn't as such strand away from its pod. It would have stranded in the context of its pod being with it. What's happened is it's basically stranded itself and its pod have moved away. So it's not like it was ever separated from its pod to begin with. It's the fact that it's become stranded and then subsequently been separated, if that makes sense. And so the fact that the orca feed around the shallows is not that surprising, because obviously typically they're often hunting stingray, and I'm sure, no doubt, because we know with orca and with many other dolphins, but particularly the orca and the bottlenose, they do have cultural transmission of feeding foraging. So in other words, they do teach their calves how to forage and how to be, you know, doing these things. So the fact that the orca, the calf was in the shallows with its parents kind of makes a lot of sense, because the bottom line is I'm sure they were probably all actively feeding at the time that the calf unfortunately got stuck on the rocks.
Right. But how difficult is it for a four-month-old calf like Toa to survive on its own, even like if under human care?
It's incredibly difficult from the point of view of the fact that there's a couple of things. You've got the nutritional needs of the animals, which at the moment is being met as best as possible by humans, as in through electrolytes and through formula and things like that. So that's one thing. But of course, the biggest aspect to any animal when it's separated, and especially at such a young age, is the potential for stress. You get stress-induced issues, stress myopathy. The animal needs to keep moving to be able to obviously release its lactate. And basically, there's a lot of stress. That it's in a very unusual environment with a lot of human contact at the moment under very unusual circumstances. So stress continues to be a major issue for this animal, and hence the real importance of reuniting with its own pod as soon as possible.
But what are the chance, like, what will happen to the calf, like in this case Toa, if we don't find its pod?
The honest answer is I really don't know. The reality of it is obviously the jurisdiction of care of animals when it comes to marine mammals in New Zealand falls to the Department of Conservation. We are not in a position in the New Zealand context to ever care for an animal in captivity. We do not have facilities, and actually New Zealand has quite a strong stance on captive facilities when it comes to marine mammals. We do not have such facilities in this country anymore. So the reality of it is unfortunately there aren't many options with the case of Toa. We've just got to assume and hope there is a chance that basically there is a possibility of her being reunited with the pod. But the reality of it is her strengths and her stress levels will only held up for so long anyway. It's not like this is an ongoing event that an animal can sustain. So, yes, there will be careful need to balance the ideal outcome of basically releasing an animal back to its natal pod and hopefully making sure that we've got a successful outcome versus managing the individual welfare needs of an animal should it find itself starting to decline because of either inappropriate nutrition or because basically at the end of the day, stress levels have become far too much.
Right.
So we can only hope for the best, but at the moment we've got a long way to go and we really need to find that pod in the first instance to have any hope really of a happy ending.
Well, my final question is, if we can't find that pod, is it possible in the orca world for have another pod except Toa and foster it?
Possibly, yes. I mean, I think it's fair to say that in many marine mammals, not just orca, you do see examples of not only same species adoptions, but in some cases, interspecies adoptions. So, for example, there has been in the Gulf over the last year or so frequent reportings of bottlenose dolphins with a common dolphin calf that they seem to, for whatever reason, somehow adopted or something, because it's part of their pod and it's been with them for quite some time now. And we do see that happening. The problem we have, the biggest challenge we have, is that it being adopted into another pod or another group is only part of the story, isn't it? Because for it to survive, it needs to feed. So that pod that it gets adopted into would need to ensure that it has a lactating female that's able to feed the calf. So it's not just a case of when you can find another group of orca and introduce it, because I'm not saying socially that wouldn't work, but if there's no mechanism to feed that calf, it's going to have a pretty miserable demise, unfortunately, if it can't feed. So that's why I think, although there has been multiple reportings of various different potential pods that have been located around New Zealand over this last 48 or so hours, the importance of finding the right pod, or at least having assurance that whichever pod it goes to has an actively lactating female to feed it, is the difference between releasing an animal into a good environment versus potentially releasing it back only to staff. And of course, nobody would want that. Nobody would want that outcome. So I think it's really important that the time that they're taking to assess that they've got the right pod is incredibly important, because if they don't, we might feel better for ourselves for saying, yes, we've released it back, but we'd only be releasing it back to basically starve. And of course, as I say, nobody would want that.
Okay. Thanks for your time, Karen. We would love to see a happy ending to this.
Absolutely. And I, as I say, we still have some hope at this point. I think the fact that we've got a different stance on this scenario where the animal has been given electrolytes and it has been given nutrition and is obviously having careful monitoring, there are active veterinarians involved in this process, and I think that's a big, big advantage to previous scenarios where we haven't necessarily have active veterinarians involved in the process. So all up, I think the Toro is in as good a condition as he can be at the moment. We've just got to be mindful of that stress, even with appropriate nutrition, is not good for any of us. We know that as mammals ourselves. So the sooner we can relocate an animal, a pod that has a female in it, ideally the mother, that can feed, the greater the chance of successful outcome.
That was Professor Karen Stockin from Massey University. And in the Department of Conservation's latest update over at 11:30 this morning, Marine Species Manager Ian Angus said support has been significant, but with worsening weather conditions, people are urged to keep away unless they are directly involved with the operation. And people are also asked not to fly drones over the site. Doc also said anyone who sights orca pods off the lower North Island's west coast, particularly between Wellington and Taranaki, are urged to provide as much information as possible to the department through the email wellington@doc.govt.nz or by calling the department's emergency hotline on 0800 Doc Hot or 0800 362 468 and provide any essential information, including the location, the direction of travel of the animals and photographs or videos which clearly shows the saddle or the back markings of the animals and their dorsal fins. And we have still a bit of time left, so if you have any thoughts to our part of, on our stories that we did throughout the whole show, you can text me and Connor on 5395 or just call us on 309 3879.
That was The Wire.
Ko ra te hotaka katoa mo tēnei rā. And that's all for the Thursday Wire for today, the 4 July 15th. Nē te mihi kia koutou katoa I kōrero me ki a mātou mō tēnei rā. Thanks to those who spoke to us today. We got Labour MP Dr. Duncan Webb, clinical psychologist and the CEO of Umbrella Wellbeing, Gaina Parkin, Service Network Development Manager at Auckland Transport Pete Moth, Greater Auckland's editor Matt Lowry, and Massey University's School of Natural and Computational Sciences Professor Karen Stockin. And also a huge thanks to my producer Connor Head McCarthy, who is making his Thursday Wire debut. Hopefully that isn't too stressed.
No, it was all good. We got it. We got there in the end.
We got there in the end, and you did a fantastic job today, I must say.
Thanks, Justin. You've been a fantastic host.
Ka hoki mai mātou a Te Rā Wiki. We will be back next week. I'm handing you over to the 1-4 now and sign you off with some Pickle Darling. E whakarongo ana koe ki te irirangi pōho. You're tuned into 95BFM. Mā te wā.
That was a 95BFM podcast. Support 95BFM with a B-card. Go to 95BFM.com/signup.